A generation ago, if you were experiencing hearing loss and you'd already gotten all the help you could from hearing aids, there wouldn't be much else to try. That's changed. Today, in many cases, even people with deafness can hear again with help from cochlear implants. But regaining the ability to hear isn't as simple as flipping a switch. It can take years for the brain to relearn hearing once the digital devices are in place, as Rob Jefferson learned when he got the implants a few years ago. I'm Gina Kaufman, and you're listening to an encore edition of KCUR's Central Standard. Here's Rob with his story of hearing loss, followed by his fascinating journey back to the world of sound.
We went to Paris for our 30th anniversary. If you're familiar with pictures of Notre Dame, you have this wonderfully gorgeous church and these two bell towers that stick up. And I couldn't tell you how many actual feet in the air you are, but we were directly on top of Notre Dame, standing there looking out over Paris, seeing the Eiffel Tower in the distance. All of it, to me, was perfect, but when the bells rang, my wife asked me if I heard the bells. And I told her, no, I can't hear them, but I could feel the vibrations. I knew they were ringing, but you're standing directly on top of the bell tower with these huge bells right there, and you can't hear them. You know something's wrong. So that's when I really started looking into alternatives. Music was a big part of growing up. Starting in the fifth grade, I started playing saxophone. I listened to everything from classical music to the pop, the country, the rock of the day. I first started to notice a loss in my hearing in my late teens, probably about 18 years old. Once I got into late 30s, early 40s, music appreciation and understanding had gotten to the point where I just couldn't even listen to music anymore. I couldn't understand it. I found myself spending time at home. I wouldn't leave the house. I would go to work. I would come home, and that was it. My social life pretty much stopped. It just became too much of a chore to go out and talk to people. That's when I really started thinking, am I going to be like my grandfather, spend the rest of my life in my recliner just watching TV and that's it? So 2 weeks after the surgery, I go back to the audiologist. The audiologist put everything together and she told me that she was getting ready to turn them on. And she said that once she turned them on, she would let my wife speak first. The audiologist wanted to make sure that the first sound I heard was my wife. Unfortunately, I probably upset my wife because once they turned on the processors, the first thing my wife said was, I love you, but I couldn't really understand what anybody was saying. And then slowly, I heard a word, and it's like I understood that. And then I picked up another word, and then another, and then it all started falling into place. The only thing was, it wasn't a natural sound. Everything, to me, sounded very robotic. I tried to explain it as if you'd ever listen to Styx growing up, their song, Mr. Roboto. That's what it sounded like. I have heard people tell me that the first voices they heard sounded like Mickey Mouse on helium. I've had others say that everything was Donald Duck. Even had one gentleman tell me that everybody that spoke sounded just like Darth Vader.
The ability to destroy a planet is insignificant.
To me, that would be really cool. But I had the robot.
Hello.
Hi.
Hey, how are you?
For people that I meet.
What can I do for you?
For the first time.
Did you see that?
The voice may still have a little bit of a digital edge to it, but over time that normalizes out. It's just the brain learning how to take that signal.
Can you tell me what time it is?
And apply it to what it remembers sound is supposed to sound like. I do remember coming out of the audiologist's office, and there was a tree, and I couldn't figure out what I was hearing. My wife happened to be with me at the time, so I asked my wife, what am I hearing? And she said, describe it. So I did the best I could on describing it. And she just pointed at the trees. She said, well, just look up. It's the birds. And I actually stood there for a couple minutes watching the birds chirp, sing, because I don't think I'd actually heard birds since my early 20s. So to be able to hear that again was really, you know, I guess moving, emotional for me. A lot of it has just been discovering things as I go along. I believe it was that first winter. I went out to shovel snow, and I walked out, and the snow crunched under my foot. And I'm sure everybody else is used to hearing that. I had never really heard it. So I ended up walking up and down the driveway, listening to the snow crunch under my feet. Of course, that made shoveling a little more difficult after I packed all the snow down, but still, it was a new sound, new sensation. It is very, very tiring when you first start off with this because you do have all of this input, all of these sounds that you haven't heard or haven't heard for a long period of time. They're all there, all at once. And mentally, it's exhausting to try to sort through all those sounds and get them all to make sense again. I actually was rather anxious about listening to music. Voices weren't perfect yet, and I was really kind of afraid if I turn music on, am I going to be completely disappointed? And I would say it was probably a couple months after the processors were turned on that I actually sat down to try to listen to music. It was a struggle at first. I couldn't distinguish a guitar from a drum. They all sounded the same. And then I thought, maybe I'm just trying to listen to music that's too complex. So I backed way up and went to very simplistic music. And the song that actually came across and I could understand the vocal and the instruments, this really dates me.
Love, love me do, you know I love you.
With the Beatles, Love Me Do. It's just a simple three chord song. The percussion is very simple. It's a nice, easy song. And I knew at that point that music can come back. I haven't started playing music again. I still have my saxophone. And I still look at it from time to time and think, well, maybe I ought to pick it up and see if I can still make music, but I haven't worked myself up to that yet. There's probably a whole lot of stuff left to do. It's a lot of work. It's a lot of work to get the music to come back, but it's getting there. It's getting much, much better.
To admit, it's getting better. It's getting better.
KCUR's Alex Smith produced Rob Jefferson's story. Those of us who hear tend to take it for granted, but walking through the process of regaining that sense with someone who's lost it reveals not just how complicated hearing is, but also how deeply the sense of sound or its absence affects our lives. Rob made the choice to get cochlear implants. He wanted to hear again. But that decision, like hearing itself, is complicated. Some people see deafness as a culture, a way of life, and not just a condition to reverse. That's what we'll be discussing for the rest of today's show. Rob Jefferson is here in the studio with us to talk about how he made his choice. Good morning, Rob.
Good morning.
So tell me, did you struggle at all with the decision to get cochlear implants, or did you know it was right for you?
It took me quite a while, actually, to decide that I wanted to go the route of cochlear implants. I tried hearing aids for about 5 years. They worked for a good portion of that time, but then my hearing dropped off to where even hearing aids wouldn't help me anymore. It took quite a while for me to come to the realization that my hearing was not going to get any better on its own, and I had to decide whether I wanted to just accept the silence, the deafness for the rest of my life. As you heard in that first piece, listening or not listening to the bells on top of Notre Dame, that was really a deciding factor for me. I had heard for so many years of my life, and then to say that I'm not going to have sound for the rest of my life, I decided that I wanted the sound back, so I had to try something.
We're also joined by Katie Locus, a teacher at the Kansas School for the Deaf. She herself is deaf, and she's speaking with us through an interpreter. The voice you'll hear on the radio is the interpreter's, and if you notice a delay between my questions and Katie's answers, that's because Katie and her interpreter are signing to each other. Katie, welcome to KCUR's Central Standard.
Thank you. It's very nice to be here.
Tell me a little bit about yourself and your journey with deafness.
All right. I was born deaf. My family is all hearing. I am one of four siblings. My entire family had decided when they realized I was deaf that they would sign. And so they took me to the Texas School for the Deaf in Austin. I grew up there. And during my high school years, I went to a public school and graduated from there. I went to college at the Rochester Institute of Technology in Rochester, New York, graduated from there with my bachelor's and my master's. And then my first job was here at the Kansas School for the Deaf as an English teacher.
What are some aspects of daily life that are different or that you think are different for you than they would be for someone in the hearing community? Are there differences we may not necessarily even stop to think about?
Going out with hearing people is a challenge sometimes because I have to read lips, and that can be a challenge, and it's not perfect. If there's a subject that I don't know about, if I don't know what they're talking about, I can become lost, so that's really difficult. Just little things like that, going out to the grocery store, the cashier asking me a question, I kind of freeze and I have to think about, okay, what might she be asking me? Is she asking me about my day? Is she asking me about how I'm paying? And so I have to prepare myself in advance before I go anywhere to try to guess what people are trying to say to me.
You're going to guess what they say to you before they've said it.
Yes, correct.
Do you think that there is such a thing as deaf culture?
Oh, yes, most definitely. As I said, I grew up at the Texas School for the Deaf, and there's a large deaf community in Austin. Deaf culture includes things that might seem odd to others, but there's a that it might seem odd to others that there is a group of people that have a culture because of their deafness. If you think about it, the term culture means a group of people that share a language. We have rules. We have, there could be clothing, a dress code that's followed. Those kind of things create a culture. In deaf culture, we have a language. We have American Sign Language. We have rules as well. For example, if two deaf people are having a conversation with each other, you don't have to walk. If you need to walk between those two people, you don't have to say, excuse me. If you say, excuse me, that's considered rude because you're interrupting the conversation.
Wow. So, but wait, doesn't it make it really hard to have the conversation when someone's walking in between you?
No, not at all. You just continue. You just sign around it.
Katie's gesturing in a way that shows me how she kind of moves to the side to keep her view of whoever's talking to her. What for you has been the hardest part of not being able to hear?
Huh. As I said, I'm from a hearing family. All of my siblings are really involved in music. They play the piano or they sing or anything in that area. And when I was growing up, I would go to their concerts. And I was not able to appreciate that as much as my parents because I didn't hear it very well. I could just hear slightly. And so I watched and I told them good job and all of that. But I didn't actually know if they did a good job or not because I couldn't hear them.
Are there aspects of the deaf experience that you really appreciate, like things you wouldn't change even if you could, things you think hearing people may not, like maybe missing out on?
I feel at peace when my hearing aids are off. When I have the hearing aids on, I feel rushed. I can detect that time is moving. When I take the hearing aids off, I don't detect that. I just feel much more relaxed.
Yeah, I can imagine that that might be really true. Do you see deafness as a profound part of who you are, like integral to your sense of self?
Yes, definitely. I have a deaf identity and I embrace that. I wouldn't give it up for anything. The experiences that I've had, the people that I've got to be around in deaf culture and being proud of being deaf is a part of who I am.
Rob, what's been your perception of the sense of community within deaf culture? When we heard that story, it sounded like you actually found deafness quite isolating. Is that maybe part of the difference between being deaf from birth and becoming deaf as a person raised with hearing?
I would say that's probably true. Being raised in a hearing family and being raised with hearing, I had no interaction with the deaf community at all. So when I lost my hearing, I didn't have the support network that you would have in the deaf community. So for me, it was very isolating. I would like to mention one thing that Katie mentioned as far as when she takes her hearing aids off, that she feels at peace. I would have to say I experience the same thing when I take the processors off at night, to have that silence. On the weekends, my wife will tell me when I get up in the mornings, you know, put your processors on, but I don't necessarily want to get up and immediately hear. I like that time of silence to really kind of wake up, and then I'll put my processors on and get the sound. But I completely understand the silence. It is relaxing and it is peaceful.
I feel like I might kind of understand this because one of the reasons I've never thought about eye surgery is that I love the time before and after I put on my glasses and take off my glasses. It's just a sort of transition between the busyness of the day and the peacefulness of going to sleep. You know, Katie, I wonder if you are a candidate for cochlear implants.
No, I don't believe that I am.
How do you and maybe others in the deaf community see cochlear implants? I mean, do you consider them kind of a threat to deaf culture in any way?
I think if you were to have asked me that question 10 or 20 years ago, I would have said yes. But now I would say no.
What's changed?
In the past, they were just starting to become popular, and a lot of people were getting implants. And that period of oh, I have a deaf child. I'm going to have them wear an implant. There was a period of time that that took place, and people were making decisions not to take their child to a school for the deaf. But it's so different now. I have students in my school that are wearing implants, and they're all signing as well.
Hang on, we've got to take a quick break. When KCUR's Central Standard returns, we'll explore the ethical questions surrounding cochlear implants for children, especially implants. Who decides whether a child will grow up as part of the hearing community or the deaf community? I'm Gina Kaufman. Don't go away. We're back. This is Central Standard on KCUR, and I'm your host, Gina Kaufman. Our guests, Rob Jefferson and Katie Locus, have been discussing the tough decision about whether to get cochlear implants, which can make it possible for some deaf people, not all, to hear. Not everyone is a candidate for implants, but even when they are, there is this question about whether people who undergo the surgery are gaining a sense or losing a culture. And it's especially a tough call when you're making that decision for someone else as a parent. Joining us now is Bridget Polson, a mother whose young daughter is deaf. Hi, Bridget.
Hi.
Tell me about your daughter. When did you first suspect that she couldn't hear?
We started noticing that she wasn't babbling like normal kids, or she slept really good always. She didn't wake up when the dog barked, that sort of thing. When she was about 10 months old, we decided to probably take her to the doctor and get checked out, and they referred us to an audiologist, and then we were referred up here to Kansas City, and they gave us a diagnosis of profound sensor neural deafness in both ears, so she's completely deaf.
Did you look into whether cochlear implants might help, might allow her to hear?
Yeah, I believe she would be a candidate for the implants. But we did a lot of research into it and thought a lot about it, and we just decided against it. I think our main reason really would be that I really don't feel like it's a medical necessity, that there's something that really would need to be fixed. And it's not a major surgery, but there's a lot of things that could happen. There's a lot of risks afterwards as well. And she's so young, and I would hope a long life ahead of her. I mean, there's no guarantee that the manufacturers are going to be around or support in the future. I mean, there's a lot of reasons. And I think that it was easier for us to just choose to embrace ASL and just start giving her language from the get-go and not involve her life with a lot of speech therapy and doctor's appointments and that sort of thing.
So language seemed like the biggest thing that you would have to do to adapt to life with a deaf child?
Right. Yeah. And learning sign language was not easy at all, but I feel like we had a pretty big motivation because there's no other way that she was going to understand us, and she has no access to sound through hearing aids or anything like that, so there's no way that speech therapy would work without an implant. And I think that ASL has done wonders for her. She picked it up immediately that we started giving it to her, and she just soaked it up.
What was her first word?
I believe it's probably milk or eat. I think a lot of deaf kids, it's probably eat or milk would be their first words. Not so much the mommy and daddy, but that comes soon after.
Do you ever question whether you did the right thing? I mean, thinking about the cochlear implants?
I would make the same decision today. If I had another deaf child, it would be the same way. I wouldn't change it at all. Now, to be fair, if she in the future wanted to get an implant or something like that, I would support her 100%. But as it sits now, I wouldn't change a thing.
How old is she?
She's 7.5.
How old do you think that she would have to be for you to feel like she's old enough to make that decision? I mean, kids have all different ideas at different stages in their development about what they want in life.
That's a really good question. I think that right now, I don't think that she would be able to make the decision for herself, but it's not been something that she's brought up. Maybe if she's a teenager, it would just depend on her maturity and the reasons why that she believed that she wanted it and that sort of thing, like where she would expect it to take her or whether she had realistic expectations of it also.
Do you ever feel like she is part of a culture that's separate from you, or is being her mother bringing you into deaf culture as well?
I think that we've been welcomed with open arms. I didn't know that deaf culture was even a thing before we came here. We moved here so that she could attend the Kansas School for the Deaf. And I don't think that we I didn't know anybody who was deaf. So to just be welcomed like that was really nice. They're a very, very supportive community.
Katie, as not just a deaf person, but also a teacher in a school for the deaf, is this something you encounter with your students and their parents, this process of bringing adults who have been hearing all their lives into deaf culture?
Yes, I can see that happening at the Kansas School for the Deaf. We are very welcoming, especially when parents are motivated and they want their children to do well, then that becomes a very welcoming environment.
Rob, do you think, just from your perspective, that within the culture that there is a rift between people who were born deaf and people who become deaf, like you?
I can't really say that there is a rift from my own personal experience. I still have not had any real interaction with the deaf community. I have been out to the Kansas School for the Deaf a couple of times for some demonstrations that they've had, and they've been really insightful, and they've been friendly when I've been out there. But as far as one-on-one interactions, I couldn't say that there is an actual rift there or not.
Rob, we heard earlier that in your story that the process of learning to hear, even if you know that you want to hear again, isn't all sunshine and daisies. As someone who's undergone cochlear implant surgery, would you recommend it?
It's going to depend a lot on the situation. For somebody that is born deaf, I think parents are going to have a much harder decision than somebody that was hearing like myself and then lost hearing. For someone to make that decision for a child, yes, you're going to have to consider all of the factors, all of the risks. And it sounds like Bridget did. And, you know, for her to make the decision not to implant her child, I fully support that. I don't think that should be something that should be forced or coerced on to anybody. It's just very personal decision.
Katie, is this like kind of the nature of this debate within the deaf community? Is it a debate?
I think in some areas it can be a debate. However, there's still a little bit of tension. You know, whether or not to be implanted or not, that's still happening, that discussion. And as Rob said, it's a very personal decision. And everybody always has opinions about what they would do if they were in those shoes. However, I would say at this point, it's less of a tension-causing issue than it was before.
We'll pick right back up where we're leaving off when we return to this conversation about the culture around deafness and the choices people now face about whether to stay in that community, thanks to medical options that are now available. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay with us. Welcome back to KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman. Today, we're talking about deaf culture with Rob Jefferson, who was born hearing, then became deaf, which he then reversed with an intervention known as cochlear implants. Bridget Polson, a mother who decided against cochlear implants for her child, and Katie Locus, a teacher at the Kansas School for the Deaf who is also deaf herself. Katie's speaking to us through an interpreter, which accounts for any delays you might pick up on. Hi again, everyone.
Hello.
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 I want to get into some specific life cycle kinds of events and how they're experienced by people in the deaf community. Bridget, when you think of your daughter's future, are there experiences that you wonder about, you know, like how she will go through them, or even worried about just how deafness might affect them?
Well, of course, but I don't think that my concerns would be different than any other parent as far as her growing up and, you know, going off to college alone as a teenager would be terrifying to anybody, whether I think they could hear her or not. I assume that she's wanting right now to probably go to Gallaudet, which would be a deaf school also. But still, I mean, there's no other challenge, I don't think, other than the not hearing, which I'm sure she'll be able to cope with because she's been deaf her whole life and she's learned a lot of great skills.
What kinds of skills?
Just she's very aware that she's in a hearing world and she has to get people's attention a different way, that she's going to have to probably write notes and that sort of thing when she, you know, gets a little bit older and she wants to be more independent. I know she has no problems at school voicing her opinions or anything like that. But yeah, I don't think that it would be any different than any other parent.
Katie, what about college? Tell me about your college experience.
As I said earlier, I went to Rochester Institute of Technology, RIT, and there were deaf and hearing students in the same classes together. And I guess I would like to say I felt just like any other student. I met new friends. I made new friends. We had all-nighters. You know, we had a good time together. We went to class. We studied hard. We crammed for tests. All of those kind of things. Just typical college experiences.
So you don't – that – Bridget, does that reassure you as you think about that chapter? I mean, it sounds like, yeah, Katie is sort of validating your idea that – just like what she experienced was she feels the same as what everyone else did, what you'll be experiencing is the same as any other parent.
Right, yeah. I mean, I don't think that my daughter's going to feel that she's challenged or held back because she's deaf or anything like that ever in her life. I hope at least she's very independent, very confident, and as long as that holds true.
What about something like marriage? I mean, is marriage something that is affected by the experience of deafness? I'm wondering if that's affected by whether you marry within the deaf community or if it's a marriage between a deaf person and a hearing person. Katie?
Oh, well, that's a really good question. Of course, there's always that aspect of making sure that whoever you're with, you want to have an ease in the relationship, that you understand each other's background and so forth. And it's often easier to date somebody that naturally has the same background as you and the same culture as you. However, it doesn't necessarily mean that you have to do that. It doesn't mean you can't date somebody that's different from you. It just might be a little more challenging. But yeah, that's always something that I wonder about as well.
Is that something that people within the deaf community talk about?
Oh, yes. It's often a debate about if it's better to have a deaf-deaf relationship or a deaf-hearing relationship, which is better, which is easier, which will last, which will not last. So that's always happening.
Rob, you were newly married when you became deaf, and you've gone through this journey of hearing to deafness and back to hearing with your wife by your side. How did that journey affect your relationship?
Actually, it made the relationship better. There were strains on it, obviously, when my social interactions really started to end when I withdrew and became more isolated. That made it difficult on her. But she was very supportive of me and whatever my decision was going to be on whether or not to remain deaf for the rest of my life or to get the implant. So overall, I think our relationship came out of it a lot stronger because she did experience it with me.
How about starting a family? Katie, do any of the deaf parents at your school have children who hear? Obviously, those kids wouldn't be your students, but how common is that? I mean, that's the kind of family that you grew up in.
Sure. Sometimes there are deaf parents that have hearing kids, and those kids are called CODAs, Child of Deaf Adults. And sometimes that's challenging because you're teaching your child to be used to deaf culture, but then they also have to know and understand the hearing world, and so that can be a difficult transition sometimes. But that's part of growing up. In general, it's not any different than a hearing parent having a deaf child.
How does the school support parents and children trying to, fill in the gaps of each other's understanding of each other's worlds? but each other's experience of the world.
Do you mean how do we help parents understand how to interact with their children?
Yeah.
Or how to help deaf children cope with the hearing world?
Both. And how to help them connect with each other and experience the world together.
Okay. At the school that I work at, we do have sign language classes that are offered to the parents. And that helps the understanding as far as deaf culture and the deaf community. A lot of things happen at the school that help to teach the kids the skills that they need to be successful out in the rest of the world. How they can interact through writing, if they go to a restaurant, how to place orders through the video phone. Those types of things we cover, those skills. And then that leads to educating parents as well. We often have workshops over the summer, if I remember correctly. We have workshops and activities over the summer where we go over those kind of topics that you just talked about.
Is there a specific kind of experience that often like really brings out the differences in the way that the parent and the child are processing the world and the information of the world? Something that those of us who haven't been part of this interaction might not even think about.
The only thing that comes to mind right now is incidental learning. Parents or hearing people are able to have access to sound all of the time. And deaf children obviously don't have that access to sound all of the time, so they have to have things told to them very directly. If anything's happening in the world around them, you know, if something happens in France, they need somebody to say that to them very explicitly because they won't hear it on the radio or the news. So that's about the only thing I can think of. That's the big difference is incidental learning.
Bridget, have you as a parent learned, had an experience where you had to kind of adjust to the idea that incidental learning wasn't going to happen in the same way with your daughter?
I would say so. I mean, everything that she learns, like she said, you have to pretty much tell them directly. Like with reading would be a good example, learning to read. Everything has to be memorization because there's no sounding out of the words that you can't get phonics, that sort of thing. So, I mean, there's a lot of things that take a lot more focus, I think, than with regular kids because you can't just read the story with them and they notice it. You have to be very, very precise and...
Is there something that you have learned about the world by encountering it with a deaf child by your side?
I would say just patience. Having patience, I think, is a big part of it because she wants to make sure that she takes the time to understand what's happening, what's going on around her. She just takes extra time, basically, to process things, I guess.
Rob Jefferson, did you think about your own life and the experiences ahead of you differently when you were deaf? I mean, did you learn about the world through that experience?
I wouldn't say I learned about the world through that experience. I would say I learned more about people through that experience. And that was more on how people interacted with me once they found out that I couldn't hear, you know, Katie mentioned going to the grocery store, going to the restaurant, the difficulty communicating with people. And you do run into that. And it's frustrating. And I do understand that it can be, you know, frustrating for the person at the checkout or the waitress. It can be frustrating for them, but at the same time, for somebody that's deaf, it is very frustrating for them as well. I became overly agitated at times while I was out. I even got to the point to where I wouldn't leave the house unless my wife was with me, just so I would have somebody there that could actually communicate with other people.
Is there advice that you have for hearing people who are coming into contact with members of the deaf community, things that could make that interaction easier and less frustrating, less likely to send someone home and not wanting to go out?
I would say definitely rely on your friends and your family for support. If you are losing your hearing and you make the choice that you don't want to have the implants or you don't want to use hearing aids, then definitely reach out to the deaf community. Get the support, the interactions from them. From what I understand, there is a very strong support group and a support network within that community. I think everybody should have access to it. Me personally, even though I do have implants, and yes, I can hear, when I take them off, I'm deaf. And I would very much, you know, like to be able to tap into that community and that support sometimes, mainly because hearing people are not going to understand completely. The deaf community will.
Katie, we have very little time, but just quickly, are there a couple of pieces of advice that you would have for a hearing person, etiquette type stuff, you know, like that you think people should know about how to interact with the deaf community?
First off, I'm deaf, not blind. Don't over-enunciate your words, because if you do that, it's difficult for me to read your lips. Secondly, don't yell in my ear where my hearing aid is. I have a hearing aid, but it doesn't mean I can understand the words that you're saying. It's okay to write on paper or type on your phone with me. If I don't understand the lip reading, there's another way to communicate. And we don't bite.
Well, I've certainly found that to be true this hour. Katie Locus, thank you so much for joining us. It's been great meeting you.
Nice to meet you as well.
And Bridget Polson, thank you. Say hello to your daughter and good luck with the rest of this journey.
All right, thank you.
Rob Jefferson, I really appreciate your taking the time to tell your story.
Oh, I have quite a good time down here telling it.
Well, that is all for this discussion about deafness and cochlear implants, but you can keep talking about the culture of deafness on Twitter. We're at KCURCST. And now, one of our favorite stories from this past year. It takes us to the woods in southern Missouri. Back in the 1800s, black bears were all over the state. Over time, ranchers cut into their habitat, and hunters killed them for meat and pelts. By the beginning of the 20th century, people had nearly wiped out the state's black bear population. But they're making a comeback. KCUR's Suzanne Hogan took a little trip to find out why.
For the past 20 minutes, I've been hiking with conservation biologists through Mark Twain National Forest in south central Missouri. We're on a search for a female black bear. Bears are hibernating this time of year, so it's a good time to do this. They're easier to find. The GPS tracking collar that was put on the bear a few years ago got us to this general location, but it's harder to pinpoint her exact spot. Jeff Beringer, who's leading the team, presses a small box against his ear.
I'm not getting anything here.
Pointing a long antenna in different directions, he picks up high frequencies the collar is transmitting. By following the sound of the loudest beep, we'll end up at the bear den. Loaded down with equipment, we hike through thick brush, down a steep ravine, making our way across a stream. And as we climb back up the other side of the ravine, the beep gets louder and louder. My excitement supersedes any exhaustion. And then Jeff stops.
She's where?
She's in that tree.
In this tree?
Yeah.
We're standing right next to the bear, but she's inside a hollowed out white oak, so we can't see her. They start to record information around the den site to better understand what kind of habitat black bears are looking for in Missouri, which is great and all for science, but to be honest, I really wanted to see a bear, and I'm kind of bummed.
So this is a radio story, right? So how are you going to make it sexy if you didn't get to see a bear?
Some creative writing, maybe. I don't know. There's some ways around it.
I think I have a recording of cubs.
Yep, that's the sound of a black bear cub. It's part of an archive of black bear recordings that Jeff and his colleagues at the Missouri Department of Conservation have been collecting. Here's an adult.
A
The Missouri Black Bear Project started back in 2010 in response to the growing number of sightings that were reported across the state. And this was kind of a big deal then, considering the once native species was thought to be wiped out of the state. But something huge happened for black bears in 1958. A wildlife biologist in Arkansas made a deal with Minnesota and Canada. Bear biologist Jerry Blunt explains.
They exchanged, you know, wild turkeys for black bears, and they released black bears in three different locations in the state.
So almost 60 years ago, 254 black bears were brought to Arkansas. Today, there are 5,000 there, so many that now there's a hunting season for bears. Jerry Ballant says the black bear restoration effort in Arkansas is one of the best carnivore restoration success stories anywhere in the world.
And from that population increase in Arkansas, we're seeing spillover effects into Missouri.
Which is why scientists in Missouri have been going out into the woods. 6 years ago, there were thought to be 280 bears in Missouri, some considered to be part of the spillover from Arkansas, and a few hypothesized to be part of a remnant population. Today, there's an estimated 350. If numbers start to get into the quadruple digits, we could see the return of a bear hunting season someday. But that's a ways off. Right now, scientists say it's about taking advantage of this rare opportunity to study the recolonization of the state's largest carnivore, which brings us back into the woods. We're running out of daylight, but Jeff Beringer thinks we might still have time to try one more den site. We start on another hike. Less than 10 minutes in, we're already picking up a signal. We have to be really quiet. We come upon a slash pile, which basically just looks like a huge pile of sticks. And Jeff motions for me to crawl in.
See if you can see him.
Okay. Really?
Don't pull you out if you yell. Don't go in.
I crawl in the den and see a black fur pile slowly moving up and down.
I'm going to get a little closer, see how many yearlings she has. Can you see her?
Yeah.
She has 3 yearlings. They start to blink their eyes open, panting groggily. But the mom is passed out.
Pretty cool.
Yeah. It's funny, when I first saw the hair, I just thought, it looks like my dog. And then I was like, wait, it's not my dog. It's a bear. I'm in a bear den.
It's a wild bear.
Wild bear.
Jeff tranquilizes the mother, and when the drugs wear off in a few hours, she'll have a new tracking collar. Jeff says they've put 85 collars on bears so far. Some of the data is showing that Missouri has great bear habitat, especially in the old growth forests in the Ozark Highlands. And they're spreading north. A male bear was even tracked to Iowa, which is why Jeff says it's important for Missourians to start thinking about bears.
You know, it's important to plan. What am I going to do if I go camping? What am I going to do with my food? What if a bear walks into my campsite, you know, and we want to tell people you don't need to fear bears. You just need to be bear aware.
Meaning don't feed them, lock up your food, and in general, leave them alone. After setting up thermometers and cameras on the den site, we hike back to the car. But the woods feel a little different now.
To me, that makes this part of Missouri really cool to know that there's a wild bear out there. And if there weren't any wild bears out there, it would just be a little less exciting.
He's right. It's cool to think you could be standing right next to a tree or stick pile with a bear in it, and you might never know it was there. In the next month or so, the bears we saw today will come out of hibernation. The yearlings will leave the den, and the mom will breed again. And if she keeps her collar on, perhaps next winter, scientists will be able to see what role she's playing in propagating the species in Missouri.
Thanks to KCUR's Suzanne Hogan for braving the bear den to bring us that story. It first aired last February. You can find videos and pictures of the bear she saw on our website, kcur.org. I hope you enjoyed today's encore broadcast about Kansas City's deaf community and the debate over cochlear implants. And a special thanks to Lori Colwell, the interpreter who made it possible. There's a video of the conversation so the deaf community can join in. You can find the audio and video at kcur.org/Central Standard. KCUR's Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Andrea Tudhope, Jen Chen, and Suzanne Hogan. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stick around for Up to Date next.